welcome to another episode of the William Branham Historical Research Podcast. I'm your host, John Collins, the author and founder of William Branham Historical Research at william-branham.org, and with me I have my co-host, minister, and friend, Cheno Ross, pastor and the voice of The Understanding Scripture and Truth by Cheno D. Ross YouTube channel. Cheno, it's good to be back and to talk all things Hobart Freeman and Branhamism and Latter Rainism. hopefully you stayed dry. We had, I guess everybody who's in the Kentuckiana, even up to Ohio, that area, they're aware that the flood is just really, really raising the river levels. And here in Jeffersonville, I had dinner or lunch down at foot of Spring Street, and you can see the water's coming all the way up the banks, and they've got the flood gates up and streets closed. And you can't see it because it's behind this wall, but our house has a storm sewer drain right behind the house, and when it gets extremely bad, it starts coming up that storm sewer, so I've had to tear into one of the walls behind here. But hopefully, where you are, hopefully you stayed dry.
Yeah, we are totally fine. We sit on a high hill in the middle of a hay farm, so the water can't possibly get to us. I've never wanted to live on a creek or a stream or a river because of this very point. Even though the houses, you know, when you get to live on a creek or a river, it's wonderful, you know, for 20 years at a time until one of these historic floods come. And we definitely have, I mean, here in Frankfort, where I live in the capital of Kentucky, it is a historic flood levels for the Kentucky River. I'm also, as you know, a fishing guide, a professional fishing guide, John, so I'm always looking at the falls of the Ohio and what the lower gauge is reading down there on the Ohio River, because I do a lot of guiding and fishing down there, and I see it's just, you know, completely out of control. But yesterday we went downtown Frankfort to help some friends of my wife's, and I saw a guy leaving his house in a boat. That's how far all of these houses were underwater. He was in a little small John boat, and here he comes up the road until the water ends and the asphalt begins, and he had that little John boat loaded down with cardboard boxes. So I and another person went over there to get the boxes out of the boat and put them in the back seat of his truck. And the boxes were heavy, so and they weren't taped shut. So I peeked inside, and they were full of bourbon. So I said, "You guys definitely prioritize, don't you? When it comes time to evacuate, you prioritize." They were all full of bourbon, but no, we're fine here.
You know, I saw a guy prioritize when I was in I was working in downtown Louisville. And I had stopped at this coffee shop, and they had it set up where you could sit inside or outside. And I was sitting outside. I watched this hippie guy wearing some really ragged blue jeans come up on a skateboard. So he came down. He came towards me. It's the reason I noticed him. He came towards me on the street on the street facing me, and he gets all the way to where I'm sitting, and then he goes over about half a block, and then he sits right there on the curb. So he's sitting there. No shirt on, you know, right in the middle of downtown. And I thought, okay, he's either drunk or he's, you know, something's going on. So I sat there and I'm sipping my coffee. I'm working on my computer watching him. And pretty soon I watched this Budweiser truck drive up, drove up right next to him. And he sat there and he watched the Budweiser guy come and open the back of the truck. Got his cart, and he put stacks of beer on the cart and started wheeling it into the building. Well, before I could stop it, before the guy could stop it, this guy took his skateboard, and he had a stack of beer as tall as him, put it on the skateboard, and just headed down the road. So he was hauling it too, but his way of doing it probably wasn't as upright and as honest as what you're talking about.
But yeah, I mean, he really had a setup there, didn't he?
it was quite a sight to see. It was unbelievable. And the Budweiser guy, you know, just chased him down the road. It was like a scene from a comic book or a cartoon, you know, in the newspapers. But, you know, talking about the flood, so it kind of ties into what we are talking about today. We're talking about the hard times that really made Hobart Freeman, William Branham, some of the others. I was having a similar conversation last week, I guess it was, about some of the IHOP KC people. They like a good sob story. And William Branham's sob story, interestingly, tied to the flood stage in 1937. So it was hard not to think of that while I was sitting looking at the river rising and watching entire trees go down the river as I'm eating. Yeah. And they're barreling down the river. It's really fast, yeah, the swift the river is right now. But Branham got a lot of mileage out of it. And historically, I wanted to know, as I'm examining my faith, what parts of it are true and what parts are not. Because historically, you can go back and you can line up through a chronological timeline. You can line up the things that he said compared to history and see what is what. Well, I found that I had to separate the truth from the fiction because there were large parts of his sob story that were true. They definitely happened, and it was easy to see that they happened. But at the same time, we're talking about a flood that decimated this area. Louisville, Kentucky, Jeffersonville, Indiana, just completely, almost, Jeffersonville is almost wiped off the map at that point. So it wasn't just his sob story. It was everybody's sob story.
And that was the 1937 flood.
That was the 1937 flood. And if you go on the Ohio River, I've taken a few videos of this, but they've got the high water mark of the 1937 flood on one of the, I guess it's a lighthouse or something over there. It's on the river. But, you know, he got a lot of mileage out of that. But historically, I started to compare what he said because it was also tied to his divine, he called it his divine commission. This was part of why he became who he was and why he's the fabulous cult leader, right? So I started categorizing, well, what parts were true and what parts were fiction? Yeah. And I came to learn that, yes, there were a lot, large part of what he said was true, and it really did happen. Some of it affected him. But a larger part wasn't true, didn't happen as he said, and there were a lot of conflicts in the way that he said it. He might tell it one way to one audience and a different way to another audience. And that became the mythology. And the real sad part about this is these guys, like Branham, like Freeman, they love to create the mythology because for some reason, people have itching ears to hear the mythology part. And they focus on it rather than on the Bible. So it is a huge distraction for these listeners and these audiences that do this. They almost, some of them, they come because they believe in Christ, they're Christian, but they have become so distracted by the mythology that no longer is what they're being taught Christianity. It's Christianity plus this mythology. And sad to say, but it distracts people from the Bible and learning what is the truth.
And I think this goes a long way to prove a point that I have often said and strongly believe, John, and that is that people do need to know their minister. They need to know that person that is talking to them. And normally, you know, it's a pastor. You need to know something about your pastor. You know, I've been a little critical of the ministers who spend too much time talking about themselves. I just think you have to find that happy balance. I know one particular man who every time he stands in the pulpit, you know, he just wants to tell you what he ate last night and what they did yesterday. And, you know, it takes up 5 or 10 minutes of the beginning of the message. And I don't think that's necessary because I always have felt all of the people sitting out there in the congregation, they also had a nice dinner last night and did things yesterday. And they don't really care about your life. You know, they're more, they care about what they did. So I don't think that's what we need to know, but we do need to know some of the background to the people teaching us. And it can't happen in these, you know, huge mega churches because you don't ever really get to know that person. I mean, he can tell stories, but if you don't really know him and he doesn't spend time with you, you don't know the validity of any of that. I think I have mentioned before one of Freeman's early followers who actually goes back to the church in the house in Claypool. This was before the barn, before Jerry Irvin's garage. They met in Hobart Freeman's house in Claypool, Indiana, the house under the water tower, church in the home. And he goes back this far, and I think he was around college age, and he said, you know, I went away to college from, you know, that little church and went and got a degree in the Bible because I wanted to understand where this guy was coming from with all of this teaching. And after he had gotten his Bible degree, came back to the church because his parents and siblings were members of the church. And then he ended up, I believe this is the way he told me the story, he went away and got another degree, this time in psychology, to understand what makes this man tick. And he never could figure it out. But my point in saying that is we do need to know the people over us. And who even attends a church, John? Who even shows up at a church with that being one of their early thoughts? I know I didn't when I was a teenager. You just kind of expect, it's almost like all of us just give the minister a blank check and we give him 100% benefit of the doubt. And you should give him some, but not 100%, that if he's a minister and he's standing up front in the pulpit, then he has to be good and he has to be right. And that is so far from the truth. That is just assuming something that we should first of all be able to be certain about rather than assume it. So you do need to know some things about your minister. Do you need to know stories about him every day? Obviously not. But you need to check into his background, and maybe his background will help explain his current ministry and message right now. So last time you and I were talking about Hobart's wealth and health gospel, he came from a real poor childhood and background. So to me, when I know those things, when I know how poor his family was and how he grew up with nothing, how he became a businessman, became successful, and had a nice income and a nice car. And then he got saved, became a Baptist minister. And his congregation said always, God will keep him poor if you'll keep him humble. And then he comes into the Word of Faith movement that is teaching this wealth and health gospel. It makes sense to me how deeply and quickly he gravitated toward a prosperity gospel. Where if you already came from a well-established family with education, with income, with a middle-class house and middle-class car and all of that, then hearing these things about prosperity wouldn't ring so loudly in your ears. I just don't think that they would. That's what we talked about last time. What I want to come to in our discussion today is the childhood sicknesses and injuries and illnesses that Hobart Freeman had to deal with. Because again, I think this is part and parcel of this whole health and wealth gospel. I've said it before many times, that when you look inside the walls of these churches, these Word of Faith churches, you see that they do attract a lot of the down and out of society. Not 100%, but they do attract a lot of them. You don't have astrophysicists and chemists and Supreme Court justices, and you don't have those kind of people because, you know, I hate to say it, but it's so true. They're not going to fall for all this baloney that the rest of us have fallen for in our past lives. They're not going to fall for that because, number one, they don't need all of this false teaching as we found it to be about prosperity and healing. They're already fine in their life, at least in the prosperity realm. We know you can't buy good health, but they're smart enough to know that this kind of stuff just doesn't seem right. I told you the story last time of my dad, who was educated businessman, came into our little charismatic church and saw the pastor trying to cast a spirit of drunkenness out of a guy who wandered in, and the guy wandered back out just as drunk as when he walked in. You know, so my dad, I was so embarrassed, to be honest with you, because I so much wanted it to be true that everything has a demon behind it. And even against the person's will, as long as you have enough faith, all you have to do is, you know, exercise your dominion and authority, practice your deliverance ministry on this person's forehead. And I wanted that to be true so that my dad would go, wow, look, that really worked. but it didn't work. And I was really disappointed at that time. But, you know, as I grew up and looked back on it, I realized that's not the way these things happen. Is there such a thing as a spirit of alcoholism? Maybe there is, but there's just a whole lot of people that go drink because they want to drink. You know, there's also what Paul calls the works of the flesh. And one of those is drunkenness. And he doesn't say anything about it's a spirit that caused it. He said it's a flesh that caused it. It's your fallen nature that caused it. And you can lay hands on that person from now until doomsday, and they're not going to be delivered from any demon because they don't have a demon. They have works of the flesh and they simply aren't dealing with it. So, you know, for me at my 18-year-old self, unfortunately, I had Bible knowledge and had verses memorized, but I didn't have the life experiences that my old man had. You know, he was a paratrooper in the Army. He was a college basketball player. And, you know, he looked, this guy laying hands on a stranger and casting out a spirit of alcoholism. You know, my dad was like, I'll believe that when I see it. And he didn't see it. So he didn't believe it.
You know, it's kind of funny because people in these movements have been trained and manipulated to mix what they call the spirit world. And a lot of times it is just fantasy. But mix that with everyday life. And so everything becomes a spirit. If you stump your toe, it's the spirit of stump toe, man. It gets to a ridiculous level. But they do the same thing with everything. I was thinking, as you were talking, you were talking about how you heard the minister and you didn't want to hear what he had for dinner last night and the small talk, basically. You don't want to hear the small talk. You came to hear the gospel, right?
Yes.
And I was just thinking, there will be listeners who are listening to us who would say in the comment feeds, did you not just have small talk before you introduced this podcast? But see, the difference is you're going to hear a sermon and you're going to hear about Jesus. You're not coming to hear about the minister. What we're doing is not a sermon. But I have had people do the same thing with me on other podcasts. They want to think of everything as either it's a sermon or it's a battle of the spirits. And so they see me as this, if you're in the cults, you see me as this enemy spirit who's attacking you. So I too get the spirit label. For the audience who can't see, Cheno's holding up his fingers in the sign of a cross to keep the evil John away from his soul, you know. But, you know, it really turns into a problem because, like I said, with the mythologies, now you enter into the fantasy world where you're manipulating people to create their own mythologies. The cult leader has one. Why don't I have one too? And I had the conversation with another guy and we were talking about, there was a game when I was a kid, Dungeons and Dragons. It becomes like a game of Dungeons and Dragons, but it's for adults when you go to these churches.
I'm fine with a little small talk. You know, I'm definitely in a minister's sermon. I just think you got to find the balance. I do want to know something. I want to know a lot about him, but I need to find that out in my personal interaction with him, not just from his sermon. Because to your point, very much, John, the reason that people go to church, the reason they should, is to hear the gospel or to hear God's word taught and explained to them. Then we can hang around afterwards, and I would love to. That's my point. I would like to get to know the minister. I think that one benefit of all of this stuff out there now in YouTube world, with all of these ministers that have fallen, people have finally begun to become a little more cautious and far less gullible. Just because it's the church on the corner of Pine and Broad Street and there's a minister up there, you have no idea who that man is, his character, his background, or anything. You need to go in with your eyes wide open and with a willing heart, but with a guarded mind. And you just have to do that. And it doesn't matter who the minister is. I'm not offended at all when someone approaches me that way. I'm willing to listen to you, but I have my guard up or something. Well, you should, because if you don't know me, that's a reasonable way to go in to any kind of religious setting or service. And a big service has been done by the fall, I think, of all of these charismatic as well as non-charismatic ministers. And it's opened people's eyes to the fact, wow, some of these guys have been in the pulpit long term. And look at this history of misbehavior in their background that is now being exposed. You know, why did I sit here this whole time? Well, I think the problem is people sit with an uncritical attitude, and you need to go in with a critical mindset to discern what's being said. So there just needs to be a balance. I don't want to hear everything about your daily life, minister. I do want to know some big things about you, who you are, what's your education, where were you trained, what's your background, what's your marital status, what's your criminal record status? You know, yes, I would like to know all of those things. And we as people deserve to know all of those things. Anybody who sits in any of my meetings deserves to know every bit of that. And for ministers to say, oh, you know, no, I don't want to share that. Well, it's going to come out. If the bad stuff is there, as we know, it's going to come out. So if we can go further down our line, let's look at a little bit in the background of Hobart Freeman concerning his childhood. We saw that he was poor, and I think that that led to, you know, this overemphasis on a prosperity message. Then if we look at his childhood sicknesses and injuries and problems he had growing up, then again, I think what I can see as I got to know Hobart by listening to these stories from his early messages is that he preached a whole lot out of his own background and need rather than what the scriptures actually say. So if you had a minister come on the scene who comes from a normal, stable background, the parents were normal and stable, and so they had enough money. Nobody's poor in the family. They were taught, you know, just general personal responsibility in life. You know, they graduated from high school or college or whatever. They have a normal amount of education. They have a normal approach to life. You know, they have a normal health history. If we could find some normalcy in this, John, we would probably find a minister who has a much better chance of himself being normal and being able to deliver a normal message. But if you come to the pulpit and your background is a lifelong background of sicknesses and illnesses and injuries, then when you come into the Word of Faith message, which Hobart did in the summer of 1966 in Dallas, Texas, and you're hearing people like Gordon Lindsay and like Kenneth Hagin teaching prosperity and teaching healing, you're going to gravitate to that right away. So for instance, in Hobart's life, if you listen to the messages, which I have, you pick up, even though he doesn't harp on them like he does certain other stories, you do pick up, you hear things where, you know, on occasion he had these different health setbacks earlier in life. One that I can remember were his kidney stones. So he's told this story a few times, even though it was not one of the major ones. But in the late 1950s, so this is prior to his conversion to Christianity in 1952, he was experiencing, he said, 2 solid years of pain in his abdomen or over on one of his sides. And, you know, he found out, I mean, that's way back in early medical science days for him. He found out that it was kidney stones. And he said, they cut me half in two. And he said, I have the scars to prove it, from one side all the way to the other side. He said, I have the scars to prove it. I was in the hospital, he said, for 3 weeks. And so that was a traumatic experience for him prior to his conversion and prior to his charismatic experience. He said in a message in the summer of 1976 that all of that pain had just recently come back, and he was thinking it was kidney stones again. And whether it was or not, I don't know. He never commented later, but he said the pain lasted for several weeks and then it went away. But if you do a little study on kidney stones, you find out that some people are definitely more prone to them than others, for sure, because I have done some studies on this. One of my employees just went through a kidney stone battle about a month ago. And the other thing is, a lot of it has to do with diet. And so this brings up this whole other subject in this healing message, John, and that is this: you know, how much of our illnesses, our sicknesses, how much of those are due to naturally caused things versus how much are due to simply a satanic or demonic, you know, attack? In these Word of Faith services, in their services, everything is demonic. Everything is satanic. And there is not a balanced discussion of people's lifestyle, their eating habits. Are you getting enough water each day? If you just drink soft drinks and you're not drinking water, you're not hydrated with water, it's one of the main causes of kidney stones. Those things will calcify inside you and you will have kidney stones and you will have problems. I don't ever remember Dr. Freeman teaching any kind of balanced series or messages on stressing, emphasizing the need for a good, healthy diet. He would always just super spiritualize everything and say, as long as you pray over your food, everything is fine. That's not balanced, and that is definitely not biblical. You know, when we look at the health crisis that we have in the United States today, just look at the absolute overwhelming of the healthcare industry. And a lot of that has to do with American diet. You go to other countries, they don't have the same cardiovascular diseases we have. They don't have the obesity. We didn't have the obesity we have in our country now when I was a child, because you did not have McDonald's on every corner. You know, you just didn't have it. You can't stop progress. I mean, that's just, that's what's happened in society today. You can't go back on that. But what I'm saying is, as a Christian, you have to take normal, responsible, personal measures to safeguard and protect yourself. And it's in every area. It's in every area of our health. And so Hobart didn't, he never dealt with that. Everything was treated as an attack from Satan. Didn't have anything to do with your diet. Didn't have anything to do with your hydration. Didn't have anything to do with your exercise routine. You know, I feel sorry for people who have a desk job their whole life because, I mean, if you do, you do. That's your job. So you have to make extra effort that people in the olden days didn't, because it was an agrarian society. You know, you worked hard every day, no matter what your job was. So you didn't have to go to the gym. You didn't have to worry about exercise. All of these things, I'm simply saying, are now needed, and they're new because of how society has evolved. And Hobart's teachings definitely did not stay up with that. But if I could give one really good location, and I'm not even going to ask for you to play this, John. I'm just going to give this to people, and I'm going to relay what Hobart said here. But if you will remember this series that he taught entitled Exhortations from Exodus, that was the last main series he was teaching in the summer and the fall of 1984 before he passed away in December of that year. And he only got through 9 or 10 or 11 messages, Exhortations from Exodus. And on the second message in that series, entitled Children of Providence, Children of Providence, beginning at the 28-minute mark, if people want to go find that message, you can listen or you can hear, and I'm going to relay what he says. But what he's starting to do at that point, he's using Moses' deliverance from the river in Egypt by the daughter of Pharaoh, that providential protection that God gave Moses, where, you know, all of the male children under a certain age had been ordered to be killed by Pharaoh, and Moses' mother did not want to see him die, put him in a little basket of bulrushes, and put him out in the river. And it just so happened that Pharaoh's daughter found Moses. This was a providential hand of God on Moses' life to preserve him. So with that being the background, what Hobart is going to do, which is really, really interesting, he sees himself as a new Moses, and he sees the hand of God's providence on his life. Now, to be fair to Hobart, he does say around this 28-minute mark, he does say to everyone there, I'm sure that all of you have seen the hand of God earlier in your life preserve or protect you when you could have been killed or seriously injured and God protected or preserved you. He does say that to everyone, but as Hobart was very prone to do, he really wanted to focus upon himself. And he wanted to show how he and his early providential protection under the hand of God is like a modern day Moses. And so he gives these statistics, John. He said at 6 months of age, so this would have been in 1920 when Hobart was born, 6 months of age, he said, I had double pneumonia, which is just horrific, which you normally don't survive as a child of six, an infant of 6 months, and you have pneumonia in both lungs. 10 months later, at 16 months of age, he contracted that dreaded disease before Jonas Salk came along with the polio vaccine of polio. And he was bedfast for months on end with polio. And again, we don't know much about polio today. We don't think about it because there is a vaccine. And in America, you just don't see people contracting polio when they're a child. But as we know from history, that was a dreaded childhood experience for anybody who had polio. And many times you would die from it. Hobart did not die from it. He did recover from it, but he had a severely short right leg. An inch to 2 inch right leg shorter than his left leg. And that was his lot for the rest of his life. That happened at 16 months of age. At 10 years of age, he almost drowned. So he's told this story several times, but in this particular message, he's just hitting the bullet points one after the other. But he was in a swimming pool. He did not know how to swim. He had polio, but he had recovered from that, just had the short leg. And he was out where the chain would go across the swimming pool from the shallow to the deep. And he said he would let go of the chain and go out in the deep, go down to the bottom, and then push off with a good leg on the bottom, come back up and grab the chain. And he said one time he went out further than he realized, pushed off. When he came up and reached, he couldn't find the chain. And he said he was down for the third and final time going to drown when a playmate who thought he was out there in the deep end just horsing around came underneath him, picked him up, you know, on this guy's shoulders and shot him up out of the water just to frighten him and scare him. And he said it pushed me close enough to that chain that I was able to grab it and keep myself from drowning. 13 years of age, he was run over by a factory truck out on the road and crushed his left leg. So he's got the damaged polio right leg, the left leg crushed. He said it was down to the bone, just the skin and muscle and tissue all flayed open. And so he said, I had that to deal with. He's giving you all of the illnesses and injuries from his childhood. And then the big deal was cardiovascular disease. So then the last thing he mentions in this list of illnesses and problems were his heart attacks. And he had had several serious heart attacks. One thing people probably don't realize, although it is on an earlier message and I could find which one it was, but Hobart was a heavy smoker for 18 years. And I can actually provide the very message that he says that on. I'll look for it here in a minute. But from age 14 to age 32, Hobart was a smoker. That's 18 years. From age 14 to age 32, he smoked. And as we all know, smoking is bad for your lungs and bad for your heart. of course, you know, Hobart gets converted in 1952. And as I mentioned last time, people want to quote 2 Corinthians 5:17, if any man is in Christ, he's a new creation, and old things are passed away, and all things are become new. But Paul's context there, the old things that have passed away, is that he's talking about our alienation from God, and we have now been reconciled to God and brought nigh by Jesus' blood. That doesn't undo everything automatically that's happened in our life before. If you were a man who was 5 feet 4 inches tall and always wished you were 6 feet 1 inch tall, conversion to Christianity doesn't change your height at all. It doesn't give you more hair on your head. You won't get to play for the Yankees or for the Lakers, or, you know, you can wish all those old things, my lack of height and athleticism, had passed away. Now all things are new. That's not the way this works. So my point being, if you have had damage done to your lungs and your heart, yes, it's possible that God can heal you from that in your conversion experience or some later time, but it's also very possible that that is not healed, just because that is what the body sowed, and what the body sows, as we know, the body is often going to reap.
Have you ever wondered how the Pentecostal movement started, or how the progression of modern Pentecostalism transitioned through the latter rain, charismatic, and other fringe movements into the new apostolic reformation? You can learn this and more on William Branham Historical Research's website, william-branham.org. On the books page of the website, you can find the compiled research of John Collins, Charles Paisley, Stephen Montgomery, John McKinnon, and others, with links to the paper, audio, and digital versions of each book. You can also find resources and documentation on various people and topics related to those movements. If you want to contribute to the cause, you can support the podcast by clicking the Contribute button at the top. And as always, be sure to like and subscribe to the audio or video version that you're listening to or watching. On behalf of William Branham Historical Research, we want to thank you for your support. You know, Chino, my mind goes in funny directions whenever you're talking. We've had that conversation offline, but when I was a kid, I was not allowed to read comic books. That was part of the Branham cult religion. Comic books were evil for whatever reason, and Batman and Robin were not heroes in the in the minds of these ministers. They did not want you to catch the spirit of Batman. But I was at my grandmother's house, and I found this old stash of comic books that they had apparently had before they joined the message. And I'm just, you know, I'm a kid. I'm fascinated by this, so I sneak in the bedroom with it, and I'm opening up and reading it. Well, these were comics from the, probably from the 50s. I mean, they were old comic books. The pages were kind of falling off as I was turning them. Well, you read the story, which was really good, but then you get to the advertisements in the comic books. And even as a kid, I was like scratching my head, you got to be kidding me, really? In the 50s, during the height of this healing revival, when you were talking about, you know, stretching your body, your height, etc. Well, I remember reading an ad where they made this tool that you could buy for, I don't know what it was, $5. You could stretch, stretch and become taller. They had the, you know, the Atlas programs where you're doing the push-ups, and you too can look like this guy who literally is in the gym 24/7 benching 100 pounds every time he can bench it, probably 200 or 300 pounds. Interesting side note, that same guy was a hired speaker in one of the Branham churches in Louisiana, Shreveport. It was Jack Moore's church, the one who was real big in launching Latter Rain. I found the Atlas program was there. But anyway, they've got all of these different ads in the 50s, and they've got things like x-ray glasses. You too can use your x-ray glasses, and you can see through walls. You've probably seen these, right?
Yes, I have.
So you read through that, and in today's world, here I am, a kid, and this is probably the late 80s, that I'm reading this, and I'm thinking, this is really stupid. Did people really believe this back then? That's me as a kid, right? But there were kids that apparently did believe it, or they wouldn't have advertised it. So then I open up, as an adult, I open up the Voice of Healing magazines and read through the ads in that from the 50s. And, well, here's a boy who, through faith and power with William Branham's message, Latter-rain nonsense, can see through a handkerchief tied around his head through his plastic eyeball. And this was apparently a thing. I published this probably 2 or 3 years ago on the YouTube site. I actually got people who were out of this movement who defended this and said, no, that boy, I knew him as a man. He could really see through that plastic eyeball. And the point I'm trying to get at is, whenever all of this was happening and all of these people were trying to really grasp for something, anything that can help them with their healing, they're willing to believe anything because they're in desperation. And in so much that whenever these guys, you mentioned Hobart acting like Moses, well, there were so many people that did this. There were, you know, you've got Dowie who claimed to be Elijah, and he pointed to the last chapter of Malachi and said, this is me. Charles Parham did the same thing. This is me. Frank Sanford, he's kind of a forgotten name because he really, really was destructive, nearly killed several people, but he also claimed to be Elijah. Then through British Israelism, you had all of the cult leaders claiming to be King David. They were the return of King David in the spirit. And Branham, when he started his ministry, not many people know this because he is recognized as being one of the Elijah prophets. But when he started, he wasn't Elijah. He started out as Moses. And he kept telling the story over and over again, as Moses was given two signs, so are you given two signs, which was complete fiction, especially because the Bible talks about the three signs of Moses, not the two signs of Moses. So the whole thing is fiction. But the point I'm trying to make, and back to the why my head went to this comic book, people were willing to believe it. And especially in that era, whenever they largely, people just didn't use critical thought. They had not been duped enough to realize that people are out there to get them. In today's world, they're not going to fall for most of this stuff. It's just not going to fly.
Yes, and I'm glad that they won't, John. Hobart never, he didn't go as far as some of those other guys did. I think at the end of his ministry, he began making statements where it could be interpreted that he was hinting that he was this person or that person, but I guess he was smart enough to know I can't actually come out and say maybe what I believe about myself because I might be a false prophet or be labeled as one. But going back to this, to that message on the children of Providence, not only did he say the things that I just said about his illnesses, but he kept talking about Moses in this sense. So I'll give you even more. He was saying, you know, God preserved Moses from childhood, from infancy, because he had this great plan for Moses' life. And he did. He had a great plan for Moses' life, and he did preserve him from infancy on. Dr. Freeman definitely felt, because he did say this, that he was the only one who had been given the, quote, end time message of faith, unquote, whatever that is. I haven't found that anywhere in the Bible that anybody had the end time message of faith. But he did say that he was the only one who had been given that. So he obviously felt that he was a special and unique person. So he is definitely trying to draw in the people's minds the parallel between himself and Moses, because he would also go on and say, just like Moses was trained in all the wisdom of Egypt. Remember, he was raised in Pharaoh's court, just as he was trained in all the wisdom of Egypt. So I, Hobart Freeman, your minister, was trained in all the denominational ways of the Baptist and all of these denominations. I was trained in there before I left it and became charismatic, so that now I have a response to all of that and can go back and combat it. Because other people would say, well, you went to seminary, why can't we? You know, you have higher training, why can't we go get some education? Oh, you don't need it. I already have it. God has prepared me from all these years back in my youth and childhood and adulthood. He has already prepared me so that I am, I don't know, you know, I'm going to be your Moses. So yes, he most definitely made that comparison. So you've got Hobart walking around, limping around, all these medical conditions, desperately wanting this faith message and healing message that he hears from Kenneth Hagin. He's definitely wanting that to be true, because if that's true, he won't have a short leg anymore. He won't have this heart condition anymore. He won't have to deal with wearing glasses anymore. His hair won't have to thin. We'll talk about that in another podcast where he goes off on Psalm 103. He won't have to deal with the pain of kidney stones anymore. He is desperately wanting this healing message to be true. But in wanting that so badly, he just overemphasized everything. Because he was poor and because he was sick as a child. This is what I'm saying, because those were two things he brought along with him, and he couldn't help it. If you're poor and sick as a child, you're simply poor and sick as a child. But because he was, he brought those with him into his Christian experience. And then I believe, because people have asked me, you know, how do you explain Hobart ending up the way that he did? I believe that he's this helps explain his overemphasis on things. He was a man who was very sick. He just was. And if you came into this a healthy person, you are definitely going to, you know, appreciate the healing teaching and the healing verses, but you're not going to just end up in a quagmire there. You're not just going to camp out there and talk about it over and over again. So I remember in the mid 1970s, if you find messages taught during that period in Hobart's ministry, he must have just talked to someone he knew up in Canada, because he made reference to the fact that this brother, and it might have been Maxwell Wyatt who was in Toronto, I'm not for sure, but this brother up in Canada has just counted how many promises are in the Bible, and there are 7,487 promises, and you just need to start claiming the promises. Hobart read the Bible like it was, I don't know, like it was a magic charm, like it was a gimmick book, like you can really find 7,487 promises, but they're promises about, you know, your washing machine can be healed and your body can be healed and you can drive a new car and you can be prosperous. And, you know, John, there's to show you how strange this kind of approach to the Bible is, this proof text mechanical approach rather than a contextual organic reading of the Bible. That's not the way Hobart did it. He had an idea in mind, and then he searched the Bible to find texts that would prove that. There is a verse, I think it is in the prophecy of Amos, where Amos said, "This is thus saith the Lord, I will give you cleanness of teeth." Well, Hobart did not believe in going to the dentist, did not believe in any type of medical, you know, practice. He, all of that was leaning on the arm of the flesh. And I can remember, you know, as I've said, I bought into it wholeheartedly as a 17-year-old. By my early 20s, I'm beginning to have problems with some of it because I was looking for consistency and I was looking for logic and reason. And I thought, well, the arm of the flesh, okay, I can understand the doctor would be leaning to the arm of the flesh, and the dentist would be leaning to the arm of the flesh, and the hospital, okay, and the bank for loaning you money, okay, and the insurance company, okay. Well, what about your HVAC guy? Or what about the car mechanic? Isn't that the arm of the flesh too? You know, where are you going to draw the line when you can ask for human help and when you cannot ask for human help? I never saw a clean demarcation in Hobart Freeman's theology. And although Hobart never used that verse in the prophecy of Amos, I've heard other people use it. They say, yep, God promised to give me cleanness of teeth so I don't have to go to the dentist. So I have two responses to that. Number one, open your mouth and let me just look in there. I bet it doesn't work. Number two, do you know what the background? You know, that is a horrible verse to claim. Cleanness of teeth is actually an Old Testament phrase for he is going to, what he's promising is judgment on the nation of Israel, and you will have so little food to eat, you won't need to clean your teeth. That's the context of the verse. That is the context of the verse. If you don't have anything to eat, you don't need to brush your teeth because there's nothing there. So that's just a case, a test case example of how Hobart Freeman's ministry, he never did that himself, but how his teaching and his ministry would cause people to run to the Bible and find a verse that says what they want it to say and pull it completely out of its context and end up with, hey, I got a Bible verse right in the Old Testament that forbids me going to dentists because God has promised to give me clean teeth.
I'm trying not to die laughing because you wouldn't want to be around me if I didn't go to the dentist, man. there's some people, myself included, who really, really need it. So it's unbelievable. But, you know, in the end, the mythologies that they created, the sad part of and the truth of this is that the men who, and some women who rose to authoritarian control over their sects, they created a mythology that was to the destruction of the people. But in the end, in many cases, it's also to their own destruction. They're literally trapped in prisons that they themselves created.
Yeah. And let me just, John, give you the verse. That is in Amos 4 and verse 6, if people want to go look that up. I don't want to leave people hanging. And the other thing I said I would quickly go give you is Hobart being a smoker for 18 years. That is on the tape entitled Perplexing Problems About Prayer. You can start listening at the 9-minute mark and you can hear that story. So anyway, yeah, Hobart's teaching was not Bible teaching. It just was not Bible teaching. It was gimmick teaching. If you look over his tape list, he has so many messages entitled How To, and then you fill in the blanks, you know, which reminds me of things like How to Win Friends and Influence People, the old Norman Vincent Peale book that Hobart used to talk about early in the 1970s. He had talked about that book. So I know that had an influence on him, you know, How to Lose Weight Without Trying, How to Have $1 million by the age of 30. All of these how-to things, I don't find that in the New Testament. I don't find Paul preaching a message called How To Anything. But here are just some of the titles I gleaned off of Hobart's list. How to Get Healed Without Trying. How to Release Your Faith. How to Spell Faith. How to Resist the Devil Effectively. How to Get the Most Out of the Christian Life. How to Know God's Will, which was also the title of a book he wrote. How to Receive Guidance, and on and on and on. None of these seem to be the type of message that the New Testament ministers gave. They just preached the Old Testament, how it related to Jesus Christ and the future glory of his coming kingdom, and how God, the Holy Spirit, is working in the lives of the early Christians in the church of their time. If you look at sermons, which are Paul's epistles, if you look at them, this is what he's talking about. He doesn't have any little gimmick sermons. How to Get Healed Without Trying. I mean, that is an actual title to one of his messages. It's like How to Lose Weight Without Trying, or How to Become a Millionaire Without Trying. We would all like that. Those are gimmicks. That's not a Christian message, a how-to kind of message. And he would also have messages with how many steps it would take to accomplish this. So again, I've just copied down a few for your amusement's sake. 5 evidences of faith. You know, are we sure there aren't 4 or 6 or 11? I mean, 5 evidences of faith, 5 conditions to receive the promises of God, 4 pillars of faith, 4 signs of a believer, three hindrances to faith, three keys to overcoming faith. It's like an Amway salesman or something. This is not the way you teach Bible doctrine. You take a passage and you deal with it in its context. Hobart would always have a thought in his mind, like, I think I need to go preach a message on faith. You know, I haven't taught one since yesterday, so I need to go preach a message on faith. What's the title going to be? Oh, how to release your faith. Let me teach them how to release your faith. How do you release your faith? Go ahead and tell me, how do you do that? Are there three steps or eight steps? And does it take 5 seconds or 5 minutes? How do you release your faith? How are you even going to teach on a topic like that? You know, it's just absolutely ridiculous. And that message entitled How to Spell Faith, people love that. F-A-I-T-H, forsake all, I trust him. You know, we just come up with all these little gimmicks and shortcuts, and we think we're smart, and we think we're cute, and we think we're funny, and we just have deceived a lot of people, because people come to church and they hear all of this gimmick teaching, and the prophets are doing, you know, let me give you three steps on how to deliver a prophecy. Here's the three steps to how to do that. I just don't think that's the way Christian ministers are supposed to preach. I think they need to teach doctrine. I think they need to teach the actual passage. I think they need to teach it contextually and organically, and not try to find how many supporting passages to prove my point. If your point is valid, if your point is good, you only need one verse from God's word, because God's word is truth, and that is all you need. You need one. It's almost as though they're in competition with their opponents, that if I can get 12 points on the side of my argument and you only can get 9 on the side that you're defending, then I'm going to win just because I've got 12 and you've got 9. That's not the way that it works. You win, quote unquote, if you are telling the truth as the Bible tells the truth.
And I'll add to that, it must be in context. I've heard many, many sermons where the minister would say, here's our verse for today, and then he'd preach a whole sermon where he tried to wedge that verse into what he was saying rather than wedge what he was saying into the context of the passage. So it's such a mess. But, you know, to your point, Hobart and Branham, all of these guys would have been much better if they'd have just walked out and handed everybody the x-ray glasses from that comic book, because that would be obvious, right? People would see it and they'd say, okay, well, this is fake. Let's just move on. But what they did was so insidious, because they did the same exact thing. It was their version of the x-ray glasses, but they did it in such a way where it sounded halfway scriptural, and people didn't take the extra step to see, well, is this actually biblical? And is this guy trying to pull one over on me? Whether Hobart was legitimately trying to pull the wool over the people's eyes, I don't know. But you have to, at some point, you have to just take a step back and say that, you know, critical thinking could have stopped a whole lot of this. So hopefully, through the course of this, we have taught people not to go get the fake religious x-ray glasses of today.
Yeah, it's just a big danger also, John, and majoring on the minors. I mean, the Bible does talk about faith and healing, but the Bible talks about the Christian life, the Christian virtue, so much more. Christ's death on the cross is what the gospel is all about, and that's really what we need to be hearing about from ministers. Instead, they major on the minors and minor on the majors, and I always had a problem with that.
Absolutely. Well, if you've enjoyed our show and you want more information, you can check us out on the web. You can find us at william-branham.org. For more about the dark side of the New Apostolic Reformation, you can read Weaponized Religion, From Christian Identity to the NAR, available on Amazon, Kindle, and Audible.